So I am like actively playing Halo right now. I've decided I'm just going to play Halo when I do the podcast from now on.
Listen, I think you got a problem. I think we need to have a sit down. We need to get the boys together and we need to talk to you about your Halo consumption right now, because it's getting worrisome.
The only thing that's going to get people bothered about me playing Halo is because that means that I'm not playing Ark anymore, the game about taming dinosaurs. And that's like the only thing that's made me stop playing Halo in like the last 2 months. Well, that's not true. I started playing Witcher 2 again for some reason. I started playing Witcher 3 because I was watched the show, and then I was like, damn, you know, I'm on PC now. I can replay Witcher 2 and then import my save, which I didn't get to do. I played Witcher 2 on Xbox, and then I played Witcher 3 on PS4. So I was like, I never had that in my life, you know. But then I'm just like, I'm going to keep playing Halo. And then I'm like, I'm going to build a castle and never look at a dinosaur in the dinosaur game. I'm just like the dumbest guy alive. But the point being that what I'm doing now is actually for your benefit, Scott. I have found in the past that when I play games, I'm much funnier. And being that I don't add anything to this podcast besides being very funny, I think that this is actually going to work out in everyone's favor.
I mean, you got the banter down, and having played Halo with you numerous times, I'm just going to hope that you keep this as PG-13 as possible so we don't get canceled, because sometimes you say very bad, bad things.
I'd never use the gamer word. That's, you can't say, don't make people think I use the gamer word. I have never said the gamer word while playing Halo.
This is true. And to be fair, I have also said some horrendous things in multiple online games I've played since I was about the age of 14. So, you know, I think maybe keeping you preoccupied might spice this up. It's much to be much better than me doing this. So,
and that's true. And to be double fair, I've also had to actively edit out things you've said out of this podcast.
I know.
So let's not act like I'm the fucking live wire here.
Yeah, I got a potty mouth. It's like the one thing that I'm terrified to do when I have to go to grad school and start teaching is like, I can't just call like a bunch of like children or high schoolers a bunch of fucking dumb shits like I do the people that come into my bar. So
that's why you got to just get that sweet college adjunct vibe, because you can say whatever you want to those motherfuckers. No one gives a shit.
Yeah. I could do that, but I feel like warping some moldable minds before then, you know. It's gonna be interesting.
Yeah, you want to get them to like think things that you want them to think and feel, you know. You want to like groom them
in a way. Yeah, I think grooming's the right word, for right. Sure. I you know, let's put it out there. I want to groom children 100% right now. Your children, I want to mold their little minds and make them little dirty horror perverts. It's gonna be great, you know. What could possibly go wrong if somebody finds out, you know, that's a school superintendent or in charge of hiring and hears this podcast and still hires me? So,
right.
This is like the worst secret I have to keep. I've done so many questionable things. It's like, whatever you do, just don't mention that you do a podcast about horror movies and say awful, awful things about people.
Don't mention that you're friends with an Italian guy in New Jersey.
Yeah, that'll be what gets me to not get the job.
That's really it.
Yeah, believe it or not, the state of Illinois not only passed through and awarded me my substitute teaching license, I think I have something set up for next week. So this is going to be a really interesting...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the next week is going to be very interesting because I'm taking over the Newton fam. I got this. We've got our Patreon that I'll explain that's coming out at the end of the episode. I have. Oh, yeah. We got a lot of people for the interview portion of the show, the second show we're doing.
Hell yeah.
Including a big name that I will mention at the end of the show. So I'm just going to assume I'm never going to sleep again at this point, which, I mean, I've been sleeping in the basement because Jenna's a COVID hag at this point. So,
dude, that's like a challenge rating of like 18, bro.
Oh, yeah. She was... I really do appreciate that she didn't do the home test for like 3 days while I was like laying next to her constantly in bed, yeah, and dripping all over the place, nasally, just so we're all aware of that.
Jesus Christ.
she finds me repulsive otherwise, just very, very dry. But yeah, this lady next to her didn't get sick. She's always messed up. She's just been kind of sitting in this nest of Kleenex and textbooks in our bedroom. And I'm having a hard time. You know, I'm in the basement. I got the big screen, the Xbox, the PS4, the computer, the records, the DVDs. But I'm surviving. You know, we never think about the partners of the COVID cases, you know, when we bring it up. And
the true heroes.
The true heroes. I mean, I'm suffering here. That couch, it's very uncomfortable to sleep on a leather couch for more than like 3 days in a row. I am waking up sticky, stuck to it, peeling off my decrepit flesh from it every afternoon when I crawl off.
That's one of my biggest, like, fucking skivats things is, like, getting hot flesh on wet leather. Get the fuck out of here.
I woke up. I made the mistake.
Hot flesh on wet leather is my favorite Wasp album, by the way.
It does really sound like that could be, like, a Wasp, a Motley Crue, like, album. There is a song by the great Woods of Ypres called Wet Leather, but it's more of a sad song because Woods of Ypres were very, very sad black metal men from Canada. Yeah. But you know, today I guess we should probably, you know, quit meandering here and discuss what we are doing. We are ending the great month of January with one last fun little bit. I would definitely say the capstone and probably the piece de resistance of the three we've covered, which is going to be Lucio Fulci's The New York Ripper, which was Steve's choice.
Yes.
And very unfortunately, Jenna is sick, so she's not recording with us, obviously. I'm really disappointed. I did not have a justifiable excuse to make her watch a Fulci. because I am 90% certain you picked this on purpose because we were going to have to subject Jenna to this.
Yeah.
I lost your sound, so I'm assuming you're talking. Oh, wait.
Yeah, here we go.
There we go. Yeah, you can't.
Leaving it in. Not going to edit.
quality programming, folks.
too tired. Not going to edit. So we're doing this a day later than usual, so I have a time crunch, so I'm not going to edit that out.
That's fine.
So... But what I was saying was, I don't even know what the last thing I heard was. This is going to be so good. This is going to sound so good. It's really funny. I'm not to get sidetracked, but like you're talking about like all this work you're going to be putting into the podcast and all the stuff that you have lined up. And here I am making an excuse to play Halo and then not editing the podcast after I fuck up the audio. So that's just the kind of levels that we're on. This is separate from one another.
Listen, it's January. It's cold. The people want it raw. They want it raw and they want it live, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what we're going to give them right now.
That's right.
You know?
But yeah, I chose New York Ripper besides the fact that it's a good movie, but it is a very anti-Jenna film. Besides the classic Fulchitudes of I Goop, there's also just the blatant disregard for women and the aggressively dumb duck voice, which is for no one. So I think overall it's an interesting and weird movie because of all that, but it's definitely set up to be something that Jenna would not like and think is just one of our weird pervert movies, which it is.
No, it absolutely is. And for the record, I'm going to put this out there. I'm going to say about probably 75% of the movies we're going to do on the show are going to be anti-Jenna movies. So we have plenty of time to just ruin her night week in and week out. You know, I think she's getting off easy just having the COVIDs at this point because... she'd be in a way worse mood if I made her watch this entire movie and sat there and then just turned when it was over and smiled at her and did a duck voice. So,
have you considered she might also just be a lying bitch and not have COVID and just not like want to hang out and watch cool movies?
No, I can assure you I get a text like every 2 hours that's just, hi, what are you doing? Do you miss me? Do you love me? Hi. And it's become a game where I'm just straight up gaslighting her the entire time. So, yeah. You know, that's the kind of relationship we have.
Women love to, like, text you the most inane shit, though, don't they? This is my 90s comedy routine, if their texting existed. Women love to be texting you shit like, I stubbed my toe today, and you're supposed to be like, aw, damn. Like, what is that?
Is this like are you the Anthony to me being the Opie at this point? Do I... Fucking broads. These fucking broads stubbing their toes. What the fuck is up with this? You think I got anything better to do than have you talk to me about your toes?
It's true, though.
It is kind of funny that between our Discord chats and the chats I get from my buddies, when people are like sending me stuff like, dude, look at this policy that's about to be released. Isn't this ridiculous? Like, my buddy that just sends me political shit, and we get into, like, paragraph conversations. And then Jenna's just like, are you having fun playing Bloodborne? And I just respond, yes.
Yes.
And then she goes silent for 2 hours and then goes, what are you doing? And then I say, Halo. And then she goes, ugh. And then 2 hours later, she goes, are you still playing Halo? And I say, you know this because you can hear me screaming. And then... That's all the conversations are. It's just the woman cannot carry a conversation of words, but if you put her in a room and give her a microphone, she will make me look like the quiet one.
I love Michelle dearly, and she can talk fine. We have perfect conversations. She'll say I'm the one that's bad at texting, but this is a text I got from her today. I forgot how much I love cotton candy grapes, LOL. God. I didn't even have a
conversationalist.
What do I say about that? Like, what am I supposed to say to that? She'll say I'm bad at texting, but it's like, if you want to talk about something, we'll talk about something. But it's like I'm at work and you text me that you forgot that you like cotton candy grapes. Also, what the fuck is that?
I'm going to be real honest.
I literally have never heard of cotton candy grape in my life.
Anybody that knows me, I am not a fan of fruit in general, unless it's liquid and generally alcoholic. So I don't think I've ever started a conversation about fruit with anybody. So that's new to me. I'll talk to you day in and day out about gore and awful, awful music and sports. But going to be honest, I don't think I've ever started a conversation about fruit.
But I don't know if that is a fruit. It's cotton candy grapes.
Isn't that a type of grape? I've never fucking heard of it. Grape cotton candy.
I don't know what the fuck it is. I've never heard that phrase in my life. It sounds psychotic.
That or she's, you know, breeding some new form of grape that's going to make you a lot of money.
Well, that would be an interesting turn of events.
It's also going to be really interesting because I really should have a grape strain.
Then I should. Well, I don't know, dude. How does it work with weed?
With weed, I mean, you can have proprietary weed. You don't own the strain, but you can grow and crossbreed and all that. I can imagine it's the same thing.
I would imagine it'd be the same thing, though. I don't know though. It depends on, I guess, how you do it, because like Monsanto has been able to sue people over the rights of their seeds.
That and they, you know, they breed seeds that do not germinate a second time and sell them for a shit ton of money to poor farmers. And then,
right,
you know, totally normal, good things that are good for everybody. Yeah, and just so you know, guys, if you're enjoying this, when the Patreon goes up,
bro, I was going to say the same thing.
We're going to be doing this as a bonus episode at least twice a month for all of you. So if this resounding, interesting conversation is really doing it for you, I can't wait to give you an additional 2 to 2.5 hours a month of this inane bullshit. I'm very excited for this.
Bro, I literally was like fucking thinking that same exact thing, and I was going to do that segue. I thought I was so fucking smart. But
I like when you play Halo because it makes me feel like the strong one finally in the conversation. And I'm really interested to see what you're going to do while you're murking people for the next hour and 15 minutes we do this. So this is going to be fun, I think. There we go. There it is. Steve got ganked and is now upset.
Yeah, that one was rough. All right. Commercial.
Let's roll the commercial and let's talk about a horribly great movie. And roll commercial. All right, everybody. The New York Ripper. released on March 4th, 1982 in Italy and later in that same year across Europe, The New York Ripper, or Lo Scortatore di New York, is one part graphic psychosexual fantasy come to life and another part late-stage giallo, as I'm going to call it, set in the Big Apple and brought to the silver screen by notable Italian pervert. I would definitely say a major influence to both me and Steve, and notably the modern poet of the macabre himself, the late Lucio Fulci.
Yes.
The New York Ripper has attained a level of cult status in the nearly 40 years since its initial release. We are literally, I think, missing the initial release by like 2 months doing this episode. So, you know, we're pretty cool right now. Just being, you know, on point
and
intentionally.
That was planned.
Absolutely. And while The New York Ripper is not quite a video nasty, although it was banned in England and currently is still censored there, and then was immediately exported back to the distributor before it could even be released, it is, without a doubt, one of Fulci's sleaziest and brazenly misogynistic exercises in violence and assault that forces the audience into becoming complicit with the mysterious killer during their New York crime spree. And as Steve told us earlier, if you've never seen this movie, we have a murderer who talks like Donald Duck. So there's that. While most critics saw the film as nothing more than objectionable pandering to sickles and perverts alike, including yours truly, there are arguments to be made that despite the myriad of offenses that are littered throughout The New York Ripper, that it is representational of exactly what it is critiquing, the consequences of urban decay and the hard-hearted public that inevitably becomes victims as a result. And not to mention, kind of coming off of, you know, this is released in 1982, I don't think it's coincidence that you have a giallo set in New York, coming right off the heels of David Berkowitz, the Son of Sam, who for damn near 2 years terrorized the city of New York, of course, blaming a dog for all his crimes and all that. I gotta believe that's intentional, and I think that's something to keep in mind. I think especially now where we have this fascination with serial killers and true crime, that this was probably a little jarring, especially for anybody that did see it when it was released, which when this was released in America, it would have been in 84. And it was a very limited release. This was more notorious in Europe and in England than it really was here, because besides some limited showings, it was basically a VHS release. Which is great, you know, to me, because I miss video store culture a lot. And I think this is definitely one of those movies that if it was on a shelf, I probably would have brought it home, and I don't know if it would have freaked me out as a kid or if I would have laughed my ass off. It's kind of a coin toss at that point, but it is something to kind of keep in mind that we're looking at a movie that's 40 years old, that is still a great movie and B still objectionably awful throughout in a lot of ways.
Yeah. It doesn't have that same there's also something to a movie like this that I look at and I compare it to other movies like this that have the same level of objectionable violence or questionable belief. And while there's a lot of stuff that is outwardly grotesque about this, it still separates itself from something like that we've covered in the past, like A House of 1,000 Corpses or whatever, which is of course more modern, but is like seemingly wanton violence for the sake of wanton violence. There's a weird in between that gets struck between a type of movie that uses the violence to tell the story and blah, 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 and doesn't go overboard. And a movie like this that goes overboard, but still doesn't quite stray from what its point is, and it doesn't go full bore into exclusively realistic violence for that point. It's still hyper violent to make that point. And I think that's a big distinction to make when we're talking about the grossness of this. It's excessively bloody, but it's still very much so shot in that giallo way. This is why Scott's phrase of late stage giallo makes so much sense. because it's still filmed in that sort of, and not just from like you're only seeing the hand and blah blah blah, but the close-ups of the strikes, the pictures of the corpses, you know, the way that they shoot the corpses for an extended period of time, the way that the blood pools and the coloration of the blood, all of that is very much so in that style. So it is still stylized, even if it is extremely aggressive. So it does kind of have aspects of it that are kind of the hit that pinnacle, that ultimate evolution of the style of horror films that were coming out of Italy.
And especially too, because we are talking about Lucio Fulci, who we'll get into really quickly here in a minute, but you know, he is, in my mind, you know, he's done giallo, he's done horror. He is much more to me a horror director and a horror writer than he ever really was giallo, but he did do giallo. One of the most famous and one of my personal favorites as well, which is Don't Torture a Duckling, which is a fantastic movie. Mm-hmm. And then transitioning into the New York Ripper, and then transitioning into the Gates of Hell trilogy, which are they're it's two totally different things. I mean,
yeah, and you can start to see that evolution though within this film. You can see that the sensibilities of more quote unquote modern horror come out in this, even though it's still within those giallo trappings. So while you watch an Argento, and an Argento is like the platonic ideal of a giallo style film, right? We talked about this on our last episode. When someone thinks giallo, they think, you know, the lurid colors and blah blah blah, but they're really just thinking of Argento film.
Yeah.
That's the thing that they think about. Fulci, and in this film, like, he elevates and evolves past giallo, where Argento perfects giallo.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of why I use that term late stage giallo, because I think, right, again, Argento, I think, is the pinnacle for so many people. But, you know, as giallo and gialli were kind of on their way out, this is one of those few last remnants that really were transitionatory into horror or true crime or neo-noir or whatever, what have you, depending on, you know, the director and the writers. So this is a really interesting movie because it is on the precipice of going into a bunch of different directions. And it is, I think, kind of one of the last really good types of these films. As anyone knows, I'm sure people know from the Mutant Fam, I love giallo. I don't like modern takes of it. I don't like that we throw the phrase around super easily as we have been doing, but it's a fun word to use, so we like the six-letter giallo. It's just a good movie. And I actually think the most transgressive scene in this movie that we'll talk about has nothing to do with anybody at any point getting murdered, stabbed, beaten, cut open, or have their eyes gouged out. I think one of the worst scenes is one that we'll get into that involves feet.
Oh, that is the worst
shit. That is the worst. that probably the most transgressive scene in this movie. But before we get into that, we need to talk
Tarantino about would be proud.
Oh, I mean, Tarantino loved Fulci too, so that's not shocking to me at all. So we got to talk about our director and our writers. Our director, obviously, Lucio Fulci, and then our writers, which kind of comes in two parts. Gianfranco Clerici, Vincenzo Manino, Lucio Fulci himself, and Dardano Sacchetti. So before its production began in the early 1980s, The New York Ripper started out as an entirely different screenplay, with a premise far from what would become Fulci's final product. Originally written by Gianfranco Clerici and Vincenzo Manino, both of whom were already accomplished writers of genre films and television in Italy, and were collaborators with numerous exploitation directors, the film, slated to be directed by the notorious Ruggero Deodato, was actually abandoned. And I'm going to get into my guess as to why in a moment. This is nothing that I've ever seen proven, but I do kind of have a theory in the back of my mind why it did go into Fulci's hands, which is going to make sense once I give my little theory. So Gianfranco Clerici previously worked alongside Lucio Fulci on his acclaimed Don't Torture.
How is that spelled, by the way? Because I don't have my notes in front of me.
C-L-E-R-I-C-I. It's not double C. So I don't think it's Clarice.
I C I. It's still double I. It's still a G sound. Yeah.
Okay. Learn. I'm gonna finally get this Italian pronunciation right in a couple of years. So
it's only a cuss sound if there's a CH.
Ah, okay. I can't speak the mother tongue. I apologize, everybody. So Gianfranco Clerici previously worked alongside Lucio Fulci on his acclaimed Don't Torture a Duckling in 1972. Following that, he worked for the rest of the decade on numerous low-budget and exploitation films, including Innocence and Desire, Jungle Holocaust, Emmanuel Around the World, and if anybody follows me on The Mutant Fam, you know how much I love the Emmanuel films, and eventually, the infamous Cannibal Holocaust. Now, both he and Ruggero Deodato would eventually be arrested on obscenity charges and later charged with murder, specifically Deodato, for their work on the film. But we're going to save all of those major details for when we do inevitably cover Cannibal Holocaust, which I feel like we need to do in the summer and make it like a barbecue and cannibalism thing.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that eventually. Needless to say, however, much of Clerici's screenwriting work would find itself being labeled as controversial as a result. And that was kind of even before Cannibal Holocaust, but especially after. Now, to give a quick summation of why Cannibal Holocaust A was an issue and why I think this film ended up in Fulci's hands is kind of goes off this little train of thought I have. So I believe it's most likely due to their involvement in the movie. 10 days after Cannibal Holocaust was released, Deodato was charged with obscenity. Allegations of real deaths were being linked to the film. It was being labeled as a snuff film. He's then charged with murder. Now, as everybody knows, as of now, the only actual living creatures that were murdered in this movie were numerous animals. There were no human deaths in this. But
like a lot of animals.
A lot of animals.
Yeah, just to be clear, it was
it's
like
a lot of animals. It's not fun. It's actually, I think, the worst part of those movies, but we'll get into that another day. Now, Clerici and producers, too, are charged with obscenity, and while they were still charged, they were fined, and then they were sentenced to a 4-month suspended sentence after everything was kind of resolved, and they proved that no one was actually killed, that they told the actors not to say anything for a while to kind of be hidden, so they could kind of give the actual impression that this was a snuff film. And in Italy itself, it took to 1984 for the film to actually be unbanned. And as you can all probably guess, if you don't know the story of Cannibal Holocaust, it is a video nasty. And it is one of those films that is, you know, was banned in England during that time. And it is still probably up there as one of the more transgressive exploitation films of the late 70s, early 80s. I still like the movie, but it's kind of not shocking that in this time period in Italy that they were kind of getting charged and threatened of jail time. I believe that this is partially why they were removed from the film, because the New York Ripper, of the films that they would work on after Cannibal Holocaust, is definitely the most likely, I would say, to get them in trouble again of the law. So naturally, you're going to give it to Fulci, because what could possibly go wrong there? So the project that would inevitably become the New York Ripper found itself in the hands of Fulci and frequent screenwriting collaborator Dardano Sacchetti, both of whom rewrote the entirety of the script into what became a profoundly sardonic giallo that pushed the limits of what could be even remotely considered good taste. Now, Dardano Sacchetti, another Italian screenwriter that worked frequently with Lucio Fulci, would receive his first writing credit at the age of 27 for his work on none other than Dario Argento's Cat O' Nine Tales, later working with Fulci and Lamberto Bava on numerous other projects. And he is still currently an active screenwriter in Italy as well for television. At least to my knowledge, I think he either has something in production or just released something. Sacchetti has described Fulci's use of sexual violence in his films, including The New York Ripper, as stemming from him nurturing a profound sadism towards women. And this is coming from a guy that considers Fulci to be his friend. So it comes as no shock then that Fulci took inspiration from Alfred Hitchcock, both his filmography and most likely his penchant for misogyny as a director. I think Fulci is probably the better of the two, quite frankly. Because I don't think Fulci ruined anybody's career intentionally because they wouldn't sleep with him. The late Lucio Fulci and was, and still is, renowned for his career that spanned nearly a half century. And despite the controversy that followed him throughout his time as a director and screenwriter, he is celebrated not only as the aforementioned poet of the macabre, but also as the Italian godfather of gore for his use of graphic violence. Fulci himself was actually a medical school dropout and, in not trying to be a dick here, technically a bastard. He ended up, this is kind of a true story. You know, his family's from Sicily, a family that was kind of known, and his mother's lover just booked it. So he was raised very specifically by, I believe, his grandmother, his mother, and a housekeeper that was female. So he had a lot of women in his life, but he had no father figure. And if anybody watches daytime TV like I do, you got to know that fathers have rights. And fathers have rights, and they need to see their children. Otherwise, you'll end up with a Fulci on your hand. So,
interesting that one might say that Fulci had three mothers. Strange.
Hey, God damn it. That's just
it's like the most tenuous thing I could have. But you know, speaking of, though, one thing I want to say about Fulci, since you kind of brought it up in a tangentially, unlike a lot of the other big Italian directors we think of this time period, like the Argentos, like the Bavas, Fulci is extremely consistent. There's very few duds and a lot of great ones. You don't have a period like Argento's later movies with Fulci. You don't have some of the like weird, like little shitty cash grab movies like you have with Bava. You have a very, very, very consistent quality throughout all of his movies, even if they are very tonally or aesthetically different, like we mentioned before. So that's why, to me, I think he trumps all of them. Does Argento have individually better films? It's like Argento's best film better than Fulci's best? It's close, but probably. But Fulci has got more consistency. And that's really what ends up being key when you're talking about legendary statuses of these kinds of guys.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I would actually say, and I think I'm not going to be too shocked saying this, I think Fulci might be my favorite, because I don't know if there's a Fulci that I've seen, and in full discretion, I haven't seen everything, but I really do think he is my favorite because he's always consistently the same director. And even when he is experimenting or trying different things, the end product is always what you expect. And I'm not saying in terms of story or resolution, but in terms of the effect and what you leave with after watching these movies. I mean, the Gates of Hell trilogy is one of my favorite horror trilogies of all time, because every single one of those movies is just a home run.
Yeah.
They're fantastic films.
Discreetly, they're each could break my top 20. I mean, but then you view them as a whole, it's really mind-blowing, and you can't really say, like, you know, I alluded to it, but, you know, can you really say that about the Three Mothers? It's like, yeah, Suspiria is good.
Yeah.
Inferno's pretty good.
I like Inferno.
I like it. I probably like it a little more than Suspiria, like, honestly, like, it's probably it's got, like, a bit of a better story to it. Less vibey, but more story. And then we shall not talk about the conclusion of the trilogy.
No, we're not going to talk about that movie. I actually did watch it the other day when I was down in my dungeon here. And late Argento. Sorry, bud. God, not very good at all.
No.
We'll get into that one day when we look at those.
When
we run out of movies, we'll end with Argento. We'll do Birth of a Nation probably before we do like Phantom of the Opera or anything like that. So just so everybody's prepared. To get back to Fulci, though, he was a medical school dropout. His mother wanted him to be a lawyer. So naturally, he pursued a career in film, truly believing that's how he would make the most money. And he apprenticed at the Centro Sperimentale di Cinematografia in Rome, Italy. And if you weren't playing Halo, you could pronounce the words for me and I wouldn't have to say them.
I know. I could just like read, but I don't know how to read. That's why I watch movies.
Yeah, exactly. So this this film school was in an experimental film school. It was started in the mid-1930s by none other than Mussolini's vice secretary, Luigi Freddi, which is an ironic...
Luigi fucking Freddi? This guy's name is Luigi Freddi?
F-R-E-D-D-I, that's Freddi.
That's a Freddi.
It's a Freddi. This is incredibly ironic, given the fact that Fulci's had long held communist beliefs and Mussolini's just general disgust of gialli as frivolity for men to never be able allowed to be enjoyed. So it's kind of a funny little coincidence there. Now, after assisting various documentary film directors, he found himself writing comedies and spaghetti westerns before moving into gialli in the late 1960s. By 79, his film Zombie 2, which is the unofficial and absolutely unapproved sequel to Dawn of the Dead, made him a success in the horror genre that he would carry into the 80s with the aforementioned Gates of Hell trilogy, which is City of the Living Dead, The Beyond, and House by the Cemetery, all of which, if you've never watched, you should subject yourself to, and I hope you enjoy maggots. Throughout his career, he made ample use of graphic violence, specifically towards women, as well as towards any of his victims' eyes. Overt sexuality and nudity that more often than not resulted in him being labeled solely as an exploitation filmmaker by critics and contemporaries alike, given that many of the unrated cuts of his films more often than not found themselves being screened at grindhouse theaters and drive-ins, it resulted in that title sticking pretty well. That being said, the work of Fulci has been upheld as not only exercises in extreme gore, but also as cult classics that are still celebrated by fans long after his passing in 1996, which is very sad. He was basically a lifelong diabetic. He had a lot of liver issues. The man kind of had a tragic life, and this is when it gets a little weird because some of it's not really known exactly what's true or what's not. His wife committed suicide when she was very young because she had inoperable cancer that was going to kill her. Like literally walking into his house and finding her head in an oven, which is enough to probably be some of the reasoning behind his, I guess, portrayal of women. And then there's the weird story of the fact that he may or may not have had an additional daughter that may or may not have either died or been permanently handicapped from a car accident. Argento says she was handicapped. Some people say she died. And some people have no idea what the fuck you're talking about. So the guy, in some capacity, has dealt with a lot of PTSD and trauma during his life. And then when he was, you know, when he was getting older, especially in the 90s, he never realized truly the impact he had.
This is like one of my favorite stories.
I think he was a Fangoria convention. I can't remember the details exactly, but he showed up and was shocked that so many people wanted to talk to him and hear him talk. And he's showing up, by the way, in crutches with his feet wrapped because he's a terrible diabetic. And just it never dawned on him for whatever reason that he, you know, was important to a lot of people, including us, you know. And when he passed away, there is kind of the conspiracy theory that he intentionally wasn't taking his insulin so that he would die. That this maybe was a kind of like medically induced suicide. Others say it was just the fact that he was in bad health. But, you know, he did pass away in 96. And of all of the directors on this time period and this genre that are still alive, it makes me super sad and super curious how he may have ended his career or if he would have kept going. I kind of am under the impression I think he would have kept going strong until 10 years, 20 years later, unlike a lot of the others. But it's a super sad ending for a guy that was controversial, but was also truly adored by the horror community.
Yeah, this is like, you know, everyone's got some like weird shit. Like, and he's no different. Like, we just laid it all out. But I don't think there's anyone that if you like ask horror people would ever bag on Fulci. I mean, you have people that will, even if they, for the sake of being edgy, they'll talk a little bit of shit about Argento because that's like classic, easy, and also it is like extremely praised. But like, Fulci was a true artist and not like an auteur where every film has to like be like this great big deep art piece, but he was extremely talented with his craft. He knew exactly what he was doing, and that's why he was able to evolve it so much. And at the end of the day, I think you'd be hard pressed to find anyone that's a true horror person that has anything bad to say about Fulci. It might not be their favorite director, but they're definitely gonna have nothing but good things to say about him.
I mean, he really did, in a way, become one of those guys too that was part of that extreme gore that did transition into the 80s that like is a highlight of Grindhouse and B movies and VHS releases. Like the things he did, while not, I think, appreciative to maybe a film critic or someone that's outside the horror community, but he's very good at making you feel the visceral edge of what you're dealing with and the really traumatic kind of things you see. I mean, one of my favorites is City of the Living Dead, and it's got one of the grossest scenes involving a man getting his hell drilled into slowly, and with the cuts and the way it's put together, you watch it and it's outstanding how that was all practical effects of a guy legitimately, like, it looks like they really just drill into this dude's head.
Yeah.
And it's grotesque, but that, you know, is a highlight of his style. He's never not made anything violent look not gory and horrific. I mean, you're not called the Godfather of Gore, the Spaghetti Splatter King, or the Horror Maestro, and you don't show blood and guts, you know?
Yeah. I think that's also why a lot of his films still feel so relevant. I don't know what I'd say. Relevant's a bad word, but still feel so contemporaneous. They still feel like, you know, there's a lot of guys you go back to in a lot of, you know, older movies you go back to, and it's kind of hard to stomach modern day. Not because it's like bad in any way, but because it just looks dated. It doesn't have the same sensibilities as currently. And outside some, you know, obvious like politically correct bullshit of various times, you see things in a Fulci film that you would expect to see nowadays. The gore is very modern. The gore is, the plots are less droll than a lot of older horror plots are. Like, there's experimentation and there's understanding and there's a lot, and I mean a lot of fucking blood, and it's shit that you are expecting as a modern audience watching horror films, and you get it.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, while we've been talking about gore and all this intrinsically horrific shit that you come to expect from us covering a movie, we got to talk about one of my favorite parts of this movie, which is the soundtrack that was scored by Francesco DeMasi. Now, Francesco DeMasi was a longtime composer and conductor that scored nearly 200 films during his career, notably preceding his celebrated contemporary Ennio Morricone in composing scores for spaghetti westerns before Il Maestro's emergence. I mean, this guy was like legitimately one of the original composers for those peplum films, the sword and sandal type features, spaghetti westerns. And a lot of his soundtracks are good, if not almost on par with Morricone. But I mean, he's got a lot of things under his belt. Now, his only collaboration with Fulci, the score for The New York Ripper, is a fitting as it is kind of ridiculous for the 80s. Notably, the opening track, New York, One More Day, borrows from the typically groovy compositions found anywhere from low-budget gialli to exploitation cannibal flicks, and notably to anyone that listens to the soundtrack, probably softcore porn as well. It's a funky, I mean, it's up there with Cannibal Ferox's soundtrack of just being this funky, fun soundtrack, and then you realize what you're watching, and you're kind of, you're taking out of it, but then it also does bring you in because it's completely ridiculous.
It's extreme. It's good, but it is an extremely horny score.
Yeah, I mean, I had this weird kind of realization while I did listen to the soundtrack fully while I was writing everything for this episode. And there's, you know, New York One More Day is very funky, very fun. But then you have tracks such as The Ripper, Suspense and Murder, and Faye that are all in some ways kind of more borrowed from a traditional neo-noir style of crime films, kind of pre-80s horror. It's really subtle, some sound effects. It's not super thought out. It's not full. It is kind of mysterious and suspenseful. But then you have this bombastic bass that's just like, and I swear to fucking God, the theme track to the original Supermarket Sweep has to have been based off of New York One More Day. We didn't do it. We were going to do it, but we're doing this kind of late. I wanted to honestly put a comparison of both of those tracks together because I swear to fucking God, it goes, it is the same song, which really makes Supermarket Sweep really, really terrifying when you come to think about it. Because David Ruprecht really does kind of look like, as we'll get into the cast, Andrea Ocapinti, who is the killer. There are some really weird things going on with this film that are also melding their way into my 80s Supermarket Sweep love that is really making the consumerism game shows really much more gnarlier than they probably are. I will put that up probably one day. Maybe I'll put something together before we drop the episode either tomorrow or this weekend, because there is no doubt in my mind that they are the same song. Now, to get into the cast, because I already mentioned everybody, and you're all going to think about that now when you watch Supermarket Sweep. We have a pretty interesting cast, as you could probably guess, mostly Italian. However, we do have a Brit, Jack Headley, as Lieutenant Fred Williams, which is obviously the most cop name you can come up with as an Italian. Jack Headley was born Jack Snowden Hawkins. Headley was a British actor of television and film, known to most for his role as Sir Timothy Havlick in For Your Eyes Only. He also voiced the parrot that is Sir Timothy's pet in that film as well. He plays our film's protagonist. He is the hardened detective and prostitute aficionado, Fred Williams, and he's working to apprehend the titular New York Ripper. Joining him in his manhunt is Paolo Malco as Dr. Paul Davis. Again, you're an Italian making a white guy's name. Paul Davis, Fred Williams. He is an Italian actor of mostly horror films. He portrays Dr. Paul Davis, a psychologist and, for some reason, closeted gay man that they never really get into, who's hired by Lieutenant Williams.
He was supposed to be gay. Okay.
Yeah, he totally is buying like a New York Post, and the guy's like putting like a Leather Daddy magazine. He's like, one magazine and a New York Post. Like, yeah.
I'm making sure. I mean, I caught that. I'm like, that's gay. That's gay.
It's gay. Leather's gay. Doesn't matter, male or woman. If you wear leather, you're gay.
Not that that's bad, but I was just like, whoa.
Yeah. He's supposed to be gay. Interesting character, because not only do they never explain that story arc, through every kind of minor soliloquy we get with Dr. Paul Davis, which is him playing chess against himself, is him saying something basically like Lieutenant Williams is a piece of shit and a dumbass because he can't figure out this crime and he knows it, but he's also not like really being that helpful in any of this. Joining the cast of white men, we have Almanta Suska, who is Faye Majors. She was a small-time actress who retired in 1992 from acting. She plays Faye Majors, a victim of the Ripper that survives the encounter and becomes more or less our second protagonist throughout the film. And of course, we are doing a giallo, so we have to have a female lead in there somewhere that's part of helping to solve the crime. She wrongfully believes that the killer is Howard Ross, who plays Mickey Scadella, an eight-fingered criminal noted for his deformed hand with two missing fingers that for some reason always looks gangrenous. Like, this guy, like, lost these fingers but never thought to, like, stick it into, like, a bowl of, like, alcohol or antiseptic.
It looks fucked up, and I don't know why it looks so fucked
up. It's a gnarly, gnarly special effect just because he just looks like he shoved his two nubs up his own ass and then pulled them out. Like, it's just really, like, brown and green and gross, and it looks like he's never washed them. To continue on, though.
Very cool. Thank you.
Very cool. You're welcome for that. You're playing Halo. You're not imagining that right now.
Oh, no, I am. And I just died. So
there we go. He is the prime suspect of Lieutenant Williams. He is played by longtime character actor Howard Ross, who was born Renato Rossini. and is known for his roles in Sword and Sandal epics and Gialli. I think he's played Hercules a couple times. For some reason, Mickey Scadella in the film is a Greek immigrant that they just kind of threw in there. And also possibly a male adult porn actor, because when we get to his apartment in the film with his girlfriend, like, there's just tasteful nudes of him hanging across the apartment, of like him like hiding his hand, but here's his ass, and he's giving you like a dirty little look, like he's gonna be a little fun guy for you later. It's a really weird character as well, but he is,
he's gonna be a little fun guy for you later. That's yep. Okay,
I'm trying to downplay the fact that he's a bad man.
He's gonna be a little fun guy for you later.
He's gonna be a little fun guy for you. Rounding out our main stars is Andrea Occhipinti, who I mentioned earlier, who is Peter Bunch, an Italian actor and later founder and producer of Lucky Red, which is a film company that produced and released over 500 independent titles and 50 films since the studio was founded in 87. He had some acting roles, decided obviously the money was in putting out films, and he has actually won quite a lot of awards in Italy for the independent films that have been released, and the fact that he's given voice to a lot of independent directors and writers. He's actually a really cool guy from what I saw. He is Faye's boyfriend, Peter, and he is the true and occasionally duck-voiced New York Ripper who began targeting sexually promiscuous women out of revenge for his daughter, Susie, who is secretly dying limbless in a hospital of a terminal disease. Because, of course, if your daughter's laying in a hospital with one leg, naturally you want to kill women, because if she can't live, why should they?
Secretly dying limbless. Jesus.
It's true. We see this poor little girl in this
right.
film.
No, just the phrase secretly dying limbless like really hit me. And I think you knew
that's
how
that's what
gonna,
your Spartan's
so.
Going to be doing in 5 seconds when somebody hits you for rocket. Now, rounding out the cast of future players are all of our victims of the Ripper, including Cinzia De Ponte, born Cinzia De Fiordaponte, who plays Rosie, a former Miss Italia and the third runner-up of the Miss Universe, I think in 82? She actually had a career as an actress in various low-budget films, and later she was an Italian TV personality. She plays Rosie, the first victim of the Ripper we do see on screen actually being murdered, not including the hand of the whoever the fuck the dog in the beginning of the movie finds, because Fulci liked dogs. Or maybe he didn't like dogs. It's one way or the other. It's kind of hard to tell. Cinzia De Ponte also delivers one of my favorite lines in the entire film that makes no sense, which is, "I'm sorry, I was thinking of Boston," when she runs her bike into a car.
Oh, that's my favorite shit in the world.
It's just one of those Gialli hallmarks where it's just you put a random line in that you think is how people would talk when they run their bike into somebody's car, and that's the excuse. That's going to be my excuse going forward. I'm going to like spill a drink on somebody when I'm bartending tomorrow, and I'm going to go, "I'm so sorry, I was thinking of Boston."
Sorry, I was thinking about Boston.
Because how the fuck do you, how do you react to that? You're just like, yeah, sure.
Yeah, just like, cheers, yeah, no, sounds straight.
That makes complete sense. A beautiful redhead actress that is, of course, killed in the opening scene. Joining the victims is Alexandra Delacoli as Jane Forster Lodge, of course, because, you know, white people names. Small
normal.
Normal three name white people names. She was a small-time actress, but she, however, is the wife to celebrated cinematographer Tonino Delacoli, who did such films as Life is Beautiful or Once Upon a Time in America, amongst many, many others. And if you ever take a film class, you are probably going to see Life is Beautiful. And it is a fantastic film.
It's a great movie.
It's a great movie.
You should see it. And if you don't, then you should get your money back because you took a bad film class.
Absolutely. She is and still is, from what I saw, a gorgeous blonde Italian bombshell of a woman. Of course, she plays Jane Forster, a sexual deviant that tape records live sex shows for her own and her husband's pleasure, that finds herself in several explicit scenes, most of which are undoubtedly revolting, before being dispatched by the Ripper. And this is when we get to talk about the worst scene in the movie. The foot-fucking scene.
Yeah.
I think if anything in this film makes me uncomfortable is a woman who is intentionally seeking a good time and putting herself in bad situations, watching a undoubtedly Puerto Rican man, I'm guessing, because of course we're in New York somewhere, and why not throw the Puerto Ricans into the mix in this film, that essentially slowly and most definitely surely puts his toes into her vagine. It is one of the most abhorrent scenes of a horror movie, I think, that I can think of that does not involve blood or guts or anything, because it is just, you can't make assault fun. You shouldn't try to make it fun, but this is just like the most uncomfortable scene in the film.
Yeah, it's fucked up. And the thing that's interesting about the scene, if there's anything interesting about the scene, is you can't really tell if she's supposed to be enjoying it or not. And that makes it very, that makes it even more difficult to watch.
It's very Fulci-esque, though, isn't it? To watch a sex scene or see a nudity in a Fulci film and be kind of unsure if you're supposed to, like, give in to the titillation or actually be objectionably offended in some way. Because
no, that's
he
true.
Does really do that, where he does use nudity and violence against women in a way that is, I think, very often mistaken as misogyny. But I think there's a point to it because, well, I'm showing you titty, I'm showing you sex, but this person's being murdered. So what do you want to feel when you're watching this? And
right,
I think that's really a tough question to ask an audience.
I think there's a degree, and oftentimes it is overlooked in a lot of movies, but especially guys like Fulci and like things that are just kind of decreed as, you know, those Italian pervert movies, which is the fact that like, these guys are, like I mentioned before, these guys are still artists. Like, these guys that are making these movies are still, are, we're not talking about, like, the kind of crappy shit that just, like, gets churned out, put onto video, and stuck into a, you know, and stuck into a video store back in the day when those things existed, right? We're talking about, like, guys who are making films with intent, and what making a film with intent entails is that like everything that you're seeing is a choice. It was something that was chosen at some point to be shown and depicted in the way that it is being depicted. So what am I rambling about? This scene, yeah, it's disturbing and everything, but when you see something like this that's taken to that next level, that is like when you go like, oh, that's fucked up even for a horror movie or whatever. It's taken to that level. Part of that is that it is supposed to challenge you. A lot of this movie is supposed to challenge you. And that's part of what I think is very good about it. I think even the shit that we make fun of, like the Donald Duck voice and whatever, like,
it's still creepy.
It's creepy, but
it's comical until it keeps happening. And then it does kind of become really off-putting, because I don't know if somebody came up to me and talked to me in a duck voice, if I would take it seriously the first couple times. But then if they kept talking to me in the duck voice, I would kind of honestly feel like I'm dealing with a deranged individual.
Right. But part of that, too, besides the fact that it is like, yeah, inherently does have creepy aspects to it, it's also this part of this challenge to you as the horror movie person, the guy watching the horror movie, of stretching your bounds of like, what is it that you think is too much? And what is it that you think is like, oh, do you think this is ridiculous? What, it's not ridiculous in any of the other shit that you watch? I think it is this kind of, again, to hit the theme that we've mentioned a couple times, as being a later giallo, of being this evolution, it kind of becomes this almost capstone piece to the genre of let's up the violence. Let's up the sex to the point where you're not titillated by it. Let's up the weirdness and all the other bullshit that we put in on top of the mystery. Something else that I thought was very interesting is you also have like the college professor character that we talked about briefly. It doesn't really do anything, but that character exists in every giallo film.
Yeah, it's always the person, a professor or a teacher or some academic that has the answers and helps solve the crime. And then we have this fucking dude who's is maybe a leather daddy in his spare time when he's not playing chess with himself, who seems to clearly know the answers and just doesn't give a fuck to help Lieutenant Williams because he just despises the man and he just wants to cash the check, you know?
Yeah, he doesn't do shit. And I think that that's a very important aspect of piecing all this together, is him not doing shit. It kind of alludes to what a lot of people will say, like, oh, this is a bad movie, that doesn't make sense, look, that character doesn't do anything. No, it requires a little bit of an understanding of these films to see that, like, that's the entire point, is like, of a character like that, he doesn't do anything. Oh, what's the point of the Donald Duck voice? Well, the killers always either mask their voice or contact people in some weird way. What if the motherfucker sounds like Donald Duck?
And you got to pick, of all the Disney characters to pick, Donald Duck is probably the creepiest of, like, those original characters, because if you got some guy going, Gorsh, I just killed a woman by stabbing her with a bottle in the vagina, like, that's not scary. That's comical. And, like, if Mickey's telling you he's going to kill your girlfriend or your long-term prostitute buddy, you can't be, like, worried about that.
Or
it's
your
not
long-term
scary.
Prostitute. No, exactly.
Like, if Mickey's, like, calling you, he's like, better get out of there because she's going to have a real bad time soon. Like, you would laugh, but there is something honestly creepy as the Donald Duck voice keeps going. And as we learn the film, the whole duck voice is because his daughter that's dying limbless in a hospital of a terminal disease likes this book with this duck character, and she's got this little duck statue, because, of course, it's not a giallo if we don't have this really obscure prop or element that we come back to revisit that really serves no purpose but to explain a minor thing, which is, like, the voice.
Right.
But it's still just, it's creepy. I can't look at ducks the same way again.
I personally, it's not creepy at all to me. It's goofy as fuck. No pun intended. It's absolutely stupid. But I do think that that's part of the allure of this movie. It does have, it has the cross-pollination of, like, your classic midnight movie. You watch it with your boys, you have some pizza and some beers, and you'll watch the weird Italian pervert movie, and you have a good time. But if you do want to do this bullshit, which is pretend like a film is deeper while you play Halo on a podcast and no one listens to, it does have deeper meaning if you...
People listen to us, don't say that.
No, I know.
Maybe not now because you're playing Halo, but they do listen.
No, I know. And we love the listeners. You're not dumb pigs.
We have the highest respect for the things that you send us and or comment on. Definitely intelligent and bright people.
we read them, and you're not dumb guys that we make fun of on the podcast, but you don't realize that you're the guys we're making fun of. No, but you do have that higher level that you can analyze in the new key to view the film through is as, like, this pinnacle. I think that's really important, like, as, like, the final evolution of a giallo. That kind of unlocks a lot of interesting readings, and it gives a lot of value for this movie. And it's why it's one of those movies that, like, if you look at all the critical reviews, it has, like, a 14% on Rotten Tomatoes. But if you look at all the, like, the retrospectives, it has, like, a much higher rating. Yeah. Because it starts being looked at differently. And while I've ranted tons of times about the context and not giving a shit about it, art does work within specific guidelines, and if you shift those guidelines to understand them, you get different meanings from it. And that's something that you should employ when it comes to any art that you consume. But it's especially true with movies that are a little bit long in the tooth now, movies that are a little bit older that have proven to have a resiliency or import over time.
Yeah. One of the things that is going to become one of my, I think, the bedrock of when I do become a teacher, whether I teach a film class or English or art or whatever, you know, there is something to be said about understanding what you're watching and understand why you like or dislike something.
Right.
It's very easy to somebody to watch a Fulci and say, this is fucking misogynistic garbage that is insulting to women and anybody that participated in it. But when you do kind of look at these older horror movies that are offensive to many people, I think these films still hold up and are a lot better than half the shit that's put out in theaters now. And it's me being the old man yelling at the cloud, I know, get off my lawn and all that. But, you know, there is... We've had a much more interesting conversation about this than we ever did about Veronica. We ever did about House of a Thousand Corpses, which, you know, I love House of a Thousand Corpses, but there's nothing really deep to read into that where you go into a movie like this and there is, you know, a discussion of gender. There is a discussion of violence against women. The idea of this true crime that we have ingested since it became a thing even before we had the systems in place to determine if somebody is a serial killer or not. You know, all of that harkens back to a time, like you said, where you're not dealing with, you know, politically PC bullshit, and you can kind of say and do what you want without having to pander to an audience or pander to a political party or a belief or an ideology so someone thinks you're brave for doing art. You know, this is straight up, I'm going to do this because I do have a point to this, and I want you to try to find the point. And that is something that we don't do often enough in film. And that's not to say that there's movies that have come out that don't do that. There have been plenty.
Yeah.
But
part of that problem though is, of course, like, it's true that like you have movies that become like unbound from those shackles of like trying to make sure that they're it's the movie with good politics or whatever. But you do also have, in this time period especially, and it's a lot of the movies that are more forgotten, the ones that aren't done in good faith, the ones that are just movies that like the violence doesn't have a point, it's just the point is the violence, like that is an extensive, there's like a shit ton of those movies. There's probably more of those than there are movies that the violence is super deep and has greater meaning. But I agree with you for the most part. I just wanted to put in that caveat.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, there is, you know, I look at a movie like this where we've talked about it and we've kind of thrown a lot out for all you guys to think about. But, you know, I recently finished the Matrix trilogy and I rewatched and I finally got through Revolutions. And I did. I had fun. It is what it is. But the point I want to get to is, you remember when The Matrix came out and everybody was, and it still is, it's a fucking, like an alt-right thing and a fucking crypto bro thing. It's, you're going to take the red pill or the blue pill, bro. Are we in a matrix? Are we in a simulation? And you really, when that becomes part of like the cultural subconscious for like a decade and longer, it's almost fucking 20 years of The Matrix. It really loses value. I rewatched those movies and really besides the original one, I don't think I gave any other of them greater than 2.5 stars, because are they fun? Oh yeah, I had a ton of fun of Revolutions, just to put that out there for everybody, or Resurrections, whatever the fuck it was called.
Yeah,
it was fun. I had a lot of fun. I liked the little changes they did, but was there any greater story or something to take away from it? No, and that's not because Lana Wachowski didn't do a good job, although I have caveats on a lot of the things she did in that film. It's the fact that I don't think the dialogue and the conversation with The Matrix ever really was important. And I think we see that now. We're in a movie like this because it is less known and it is, you know, a film that is appreciated like by sickos and perverts like myself. You do kind of have a more nuanced conversation because it's with a smaller group of people. It's not something that's just thrown out there
right
willy-nilly over the internet where everyone's talking about it. And that's kind of one of the reasons why I think we do this show a little bit, is we do bring up these horror movies, these older films, some new films that do have a lot to say but aren't also part of that big cultural exchange, because they don't need to be, but those conversations still need to be had. And we are very unwilling as a society, especially over the last 2 years, to have any conversation with each other if we don't agree.
Yeah, I don't want to keep putting like caveat emptors on everything you say, because I agree with you, but I just want to expand on that. There is an aspect though, and it's something that like it's kind of tied to what I was saying before that we need to watch out for, though, too, is we do have a thing, and this comes from both sides, but it also comes from this aspect where we as a society have like this myth that there are two sides to every argument, that there aren't things that are just facts that exist. Yeah. And I'm not going to say what things are facts or not. I don't want to get into that.
Climate save change, that for after vaccine. Hours when we get
climate really change vaccinations. But there's a myth that everyone's opinions are important. And so there are a lot of films that are trash, that are just trash. You can enjoy them and like them, but they don't mean anything. And there are films that can be deep and have a little bit of something to say, but don't have a huge amount to say. And that happens with everything. So whether you're talking about having a conversation, not all conversations need to be had. Not all films need to be dug into greatly. But you'll find that in you as an English guy definitely will get this. Everyone should know how to critique. I don't want to get into like this whole
meta
thing.
Not only critique, but know how to do basic explanations of what logic is. I mean, like an actual, like using, you know, the actual philosophy behind logic.
Real logic, not real Ben logic. Shapiro. So if that's the case, then like that's bullshit. Like actual understanding of like your rudimentary, like if this, then that, like. That's the stuff that Ben Shapiro thinks he's doing. That's not rhetoric. That's not logic.
That's just rhetoric.
That's not logic.
It's completely different.
Rhetoric gets a bad rap, not to get onto too much of a tangent, but rhetoric gets a bad rap. Rhetoric is like a field you can study to make yourself become better at doing argumentation. But that's not the actual core of what logic and reason is.
And the problem, too, with rhetoric, and this is endemic world over, and I think it's just something that's innately human, is we really have a hard time with discussing anything that we cannot make a dichotomy. Left versus right, yeah. Blue versus red, top versus bottom, what the fuck have you, whatever. It's very hard to have a conversation with somebody and try to make them even not appreciate another side. You don't have to have a conversation with somebody that's very left and be a person that's on the right and try to justify something like the alt-right or QAnon bullshit. That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm trying to say is it's very hard for people to get out of a comfort zone to have a discussion, because when you deal with only one or the other, you feel like you have to be in a certain camp, part of a certain team, and then you take this weird kind of sardonic pride in being part of it, even if it's not something you fully believe, because you cannot use logic to understand that there are things about something you might like that can be problematic, that can be bad, that can be not in your favor or not beneficial to somebody else. And that's kind of, I think, one of the reasons why I love doing this show, is just to give some of you guys out there something to listen to, learn a little bit about the films, let us be weird, occasionally funny perverts, but also hopefully leave with something to, you know, a discussion point when you're sitting at the bar having a beer with a friend talking about a movie, you know? It's important things. I think
that when we're at like whatever fucking episode we are in here, I think that it's good to kind of see what our mission statement has been this whole time, which is like, yeah, we're talking about cool movies that we like, but we want you to start thinking about these movies too. Like, I, not just because I'm embarrassed at you pigs, which I am. But no. But
I love all of you. You're all beautiful and unique children of God.
But horror gets this rap of being like, you know, movies for dipshits and perverts, and that's not true. We know how much variation and how much art is present in horror, this genre that we love. That for so many people, like, unlike many other genres of films, like, we attach as like an important part of our personality in our life. Like, how many people out there is like entire thing is like, yeah, I'm an action movie fan. Oh yeah, I'm a big drama head. Like
Aaron Brockovich, watch it twice a week. Have been since it's released. Love a good drama. Love a strong woman.
So you don't see that. There's a reason why this is like, it's so beautiful and
fun.
Such a fun, yeah, so fun, and it has so much to say that you got to watch these movies. You got to be able to differentiate and say this movie's a dipshit, dumb fun movie. This movie's got a little bit something to it. This movie's got a lot to it. And you got to understand why. Don't just read your fucking AV Club review or whatever and pick out shit from that. Like, if you want and want to try to sound like you know what you're talking about, I'll know. Like, me especially, I'll know. I won't think you're cool. I'll be embarrassed.
I think a dumb thought, and he legitimately psychically attacks me and gives me a migraine. It happens at least 3 times a week. It's fucking awful.
So, like, do that work. It's a phrase that gets said a lot for a lot of different things, but like, if you want to be a fan, do be a good fan. Like, be a cool fan. Be a fan that understands the shit. You know, you can, oh, I know every single, I know the Wes Craven's birthday and the address of the house he was born in. Like, no, that's not fan. That's not fan shit.
That's just like hoarding facts, you know.
tell me about the cool homosexual undertones of Nightmare on Elm Street 2, and what that means. Not just that it's gay. Like, why it's cool that it's gay. like get into that shit. Like, and even movies like this that you might not think have are deep, try to find the meaning. And part of that, the thing that's important is the trying. Even if you watch a movie and you're like, nah, this got nothing to it. Like, it's Veronica. It's got nothing in it. You did the work. You did the work to attempt to do that, and it's made you better at criticism because you've been
probably
able
made you hate Glenn Danzig even more than you do.
Well, yeah, more than you but probably still not enough. Probably still not as much as you should. But you know what I mean? Like, I know this has gotten onto a tangent, but I think this is the perfect movie for this tangent to happen with, because this is a movie that's been so maligned over time, and then yet has now also become like really lauded as like a big deal good movie, not just like a schlock fest. And it can be both. It really is, which is why I give this movie a firm 3, and I like it. I know it probably seems like I'm effusive about it, but I am. I really like this movie. I think there's a lot about it that doesn't work. I don't think the Donald Duck voice works. I don't think actually it's because my daughter can't be beautiful. It doesn't really do anything, but it is interesting, and it does have a deeper attempt at meaning that you can see as something I say a lot, at least, and maybe not Scott, but Scott's agreed with me at least on this. There's a lot of times you can watch a movie and you can see like, oh, that's what they're trying to do. You can see how it's like written on the page, where it's like, oh, the killer, tormented by his daughter's deformity, bristles at the sight of beauty. But then at the end of the day, it's still like, oh, it's a giallo movie with a guy making a duck sound, and so it's goofy as fuck. Like I can see what the meaning is supposed to be. I can see why it's supposed to be cool, but the execution's still not there, right? We're not just talking about the meaning of art. We're still talking about the execution of the art, which is why you can really like a movie that has absolutely no plot and sucks shit in that regard, but has awesome special effects. Shit like that happens constantly. So this is a good movie if you want to try to do, you know, they're calling it the Groovy Little Spook Show Challenge. Go and watch this movie again and think about the shit that we're saying, and see if you can think of how we got to those points. And if you can and agree, cool. If you don't and can't and don't get it, cool. You still did the thing. You still did that. You still looked at it and thought over it. If anything, it's better if you disagree with us. And I'll think you're a dumb guy, but it's better for your growth that you disagree with us. And then go and watch another movie and try to implement that same shit without having our points stuck in your head, and make your own.
And then I mean,
for the love of God, we're two fucking schmucks at the end of the day. If you disagree with us, as long as you did the work, that makes us happy. You can, you know, you can spit in my face and call me a moron, but if you tell me why you hated something, I can't be as mad as if you just do that regularly.
The thing that we both hate and talked about how we hate is the whole phrase elevated horror. And that's because of movies that some of the movies we've talked about in the past that like already elevated horror. They already brought it up. But what I want to do, I want to start a movement called Elevate Horror. I'm being serious. This is going to sound lame because I'm not the kind of guy that's like, go on Twitter and do this. But let's start this shit legitimately. Maybe it's because I'm playing Halo and I'm like going crazy. But it's like,
I gotta say, you need to play Halo more often, but I think this has been like our best like tangent conversation we've had in episodes, and around 41 right now. Like, you need to just completely just be killing people on the internet for this to work now.
I'm 7-3. I'm riding high in this match. So no, like, elevate horror. Let's make this a point of like not making every movie like Hereditary, but treating every movie like it's Hereditary until it's clearly not. Yeah. Right? Treat a movie you watch as if it has as much bullshit, self-importance and grandeur as an Ari Aster or otherwise, you know, A24 style, mumblecore style horror, whatever. All these movies that like people are like, actually, it's cool to like horror again. Treat every movie like it's that. Why are you only thinking about those movies like they're big? Because someone else already told you that they were, and that's why you're supposed to enjoy them. No, every movie you can do this. And for some people, they go, that, oh, I can't just enjoy it then. Well, maybe not, but maybe that's also going to make your palate a little more refined. You'll start to, as Scott said, know why you like things.
Also know what you don't like and why. You will be a much better off person when you know it, and then you can explain it. And it's going to just, if you start with movies or music or entertainment, and then you start applying that to opinions on other things you have, whether it's political, ideological, what fucking have you, your brain's going to start, those wheels are going to start moving. I legitimately think I have better conversations at the bar when I'm bartending because I've done this show, because I've had these conversations with Steve, and then I can bring them up with the horror heads and the fans that come in that talk to me for whatever reason and have these fun conversations. It's just, it's good for you. It's good for having conversations. End of the day, your life is not a summation of a comment that's 240 characters. You're more than a tweet. You're more than a Facebook post. You're more than a fucking photo you put on Instagram. You're a person. You have opinions. Share them, learn what they are, and we might just be better off because of it.
Yeah,
we'll get stabbed in the vagina with a broken bottle and die. You know, it's one way or the other.
And I think, like you mentioned before, when you talked about like the divisiveness of things, like all of that, like the social media. Not to sound like an absolute fucking dinosaur, but social media has propagated this, where the difference isn't that everyone has an opinion now. The difference is that everyone can share their opinion, and every little dumb thing is being constantly mined and gone through to see what's going to be the fucking Twitter beef du jour. Who's the main character today? Yeah. Is it West Elm Caleb again? Is it Couch Guy? Who the fuck is it? What's going on?
The fact that I say so many stupid things and people comment and like it. Not that I'm not doing that for that purpose, because I am trying to have fun, but Jesus Christ. There's no reason why any of the shit I say should have more than two little hearts on the Twitter, but it's tens and 15s.
Oh yeah, no, it should have none.
Yeah, it just should be none. There should be no grading of a comment.
Right. But the thing is with all this shit is that, like, once you get to the point where you're thinking critically about shit, doing critical thinking, critiquing things, understanding things, do it with something you like these movies. And it's going to be a lot easier to do it with shit like politics, shit like interpersonal interactions with people, your job, you know, do critique, do critical thought with that shit. Read some philosophy. I'm not saying because I like philosophy, but real philosophy just like, but no, I mean, honestly, I got into philosophy because it made me better at doing shit, not because I necessarily liked reading every philosopher. The thing is that, like, when you read something that's purely a bunch of thought experiments, it's purely about getting at understanding, you start to realize what they're doing. You're reading. There's the meta level to the work beyond what the thing is saying, and the part of, oh fuck, I understand that. There's a eureka moment when you read a philosophy book, when you're like, I get what they're fucking talking about.
Yeah, I think that's kind of...
That's the important part.
That's the important thing. That's the important thing, I think, to take away from all of this is just understand. See the code behind the Matrix, guys.
Right, and that's what the kind of social critique stuff that I do when I look at movies and look at art and stuff that I bring up is part of that. Even if it's something goofy, and you might be like, are you really paying that much attention to this? It's like, I don't know, it's Dracula 3000. Are you really thinking about that with this? It's like, yeah, of course, because even if this shit fails and I go, oh, there's nothing there, that aspect of doing that is because I'm so fucking good at doing that critique, and I'm not blowing smoke up my ass. It's I wish I was considered to be average at it or bad, but it's something that just people don't have. People literally don't have critical thinking skills, and it's not their fault. You know, it's Scott's going into education, and I know that he agrees with me on this. Modern education is fucking horse training.
Oh yeah, it's awful.
Like the modern education system has been set up specifically to make people become ready to go into the workforce, not to go to college, not to learn, but to be part of productive society. The history of public education in the system was, well, we're not allowed to make kids work 14 hours a day anymore. Let's get them ready for when they can work. Let's get them ready for being able to just take instruction, and yeah, let's give them some basic understanding, and we can make some kids be smarter and shit than others, but for the most part, that's like the roots of it. So we don't have that equipment as a society, and it goes beyond doing it for movies, but you can, that's the easiest way to do it. Don't listen to a some like dumb shit like rational thought, like intellectual dark web kind of like Ben Shapiro type, because they're doing it in bad faith. You ever realize how those guys who always say, "Oh, I'm a free thinker. I'm doing critical thought." Oh, really? You're doing critical thought? It's interesting how even though you're doing critical thought and you're such a free thinker, that like you've never come to the same conclusion as scientists, and you always come to the conclusion that the Jews own the banks and that the Earth is flat, because that's a matter of personal ego.
Yeah,
that's all that is. So get rid of your ego and learn to critique things. And when someone disagrees with you, they could be wrong. But you also should be, as long as they're coming from it in good faith too, what you should be doing is being ready to accept that you might be wrong. And either you strengthen your argument because you're right, or you learn something new, or you at least have a good debate and become better at debating and at justifying your belief. And that's the most critical part of it. You do this shit, you become good at doing this shit, you understand, and you're comfortable. This is going to sound like a non sequitur, and like, what the fuck, or how deep are we getting in this tangent? But I was just talking about this with someone the other day. Everyone's kind of heard the old adage of, the only thing I know is that I know nothing, right? That applies to every aspect of life. And this is going to sound like I'm doing some Jordan Peterson shit, but I'm not, because fuck that guy. What it really is like, it's not that, oh, I'm dumb, I don't know anything. It's not pithy. It's a matter of, my opinions aren't sacrosanct. I have an opinion. I think that I know something. All that, every piece of knowledge that you have is having a positive feeling towards a possible fact. Right? You're saying, I think this is true. That statement itself isn't a fact. It's a statement about a fact. If I say the earth is round, or the sky is blue, let's say the sky is blue. No one will argue with that, even the flat earthers. If I say the sky is blue.
You mean the dome, Steve? The blue dome that is on top of the frisbee, yes, that we're living on?
The sky slash dome. The Sky Dome, the Thunderdome.
Thunderdome, please. Thank you.
It's blue, right? If that's what we're saying, chill, fine, awesome, right? That's blue. That's true, okay? But that statement that the sky is blue, that itself is true, but the thing that makes it true is the blueness of sky, which is a fact. It's a thing that exists independent of me saying something. It's the truth maker is what we call it in philosophy, right? So it's that thing in itself that has that conditions that make that statement true. Whenever that's how everything that you think is, it's a statement about something that might be true. And then the fact that you believe it means that you go, you think about that statement and you go, yeah, I like that. I agree. That's what makes any of that in your brain is just like those simple actions every time. It's you feeling positive about a possible true statement. So whenever you have a conversation, you need to come at it from that point of view, that all that I have is a seemingly justified true belief. If I can be adequately proven that the thing I believe is either not true or I'm not justified in believing that it's true, then your knowledge has changed. So we don't know anything for certain, but there are good opinions, good beliefs that you can have after doing the work. You can believe in climate change and you could possibly be right, but if you believe in climate change because what? Oh,
Susan Sarandon told you that it exists, for example.
It got hot today. Then no, but if you believe it's true because 98% of scientists who are in that field say that it's true, well, then you have corroboration from field of experts. You're justified. But that doesn't mean that nothing will ever change. If they call me out all of a sudden and say, hey, we fucked up somehow, it's not true, then, which, I mean, I doubt will happen, but if something like that does happen, then you got to be prepared to pivot. You can't just sit there. You've been confronted with better evidence. If the sky turned red and stayed red forever and people are like, actually, sky's red now. And you're like, no, sky's blue. It's supposed to be blue. It's always been blue. It's got to go back to blue. We missed the blue. Back the blue. The thin blue sky. Thin blue sky. Whatever. Like, blue sky matters. Like, no. It's changed. That's different now. Get ready to do it. And if you can get that framework into place, then you're better off. And yeah, you can do that with the New York Ripper. It's not going to be as important. You're not having a belief about something as important, but if you're able to challenge the belief that this is just like a shitty schlock movie from the 80s that has no artistic merit and it has nothing to say about any of these things and it's just politically incorrect, you can challenge that within this framework. And if you do that work accurately, you get good at it, you can do it for everything else. I'm done, man. I 15 and 10 that round. That was all right.
Oh, man. Go figure. We went from the New York Ripper to a deep philosophical conversation. So if you enjoyed this, just wait till you get to After Hours when we get some really interesting conversations that aren't about movies.
That's just going to be dick and fart jokes.
It's really just going to be dick and fart jokes, absolutely. For the record, 3.5 stars from me. One of my more favorite Fulcis, but not the best. But also, as you can see, quite a lot of fun to talk about. What do we have in store for everybody coming up? Well, Giallo-ery is now over. We are doing no more Giallo, at least for the month, because it's over. February, of course, is the most sacred month as well. For Saturnalia, so we're going to get turnt for Saturnalia. We're going to celebrate films of blood, beasts, and or breasts in any combination, which means we're going to do vampires. We're going to do werewolves. We're going to see titty. We might see multiple titties. Is there going to be blood? You betcha. And the first film we're going to do is actually a vampire film that I'm going to pick, even though werewolf films are more my thing, and we are going to take on Vamp with the beautiful and very talented Grace Jones.
Yeah, I love this fucking movie. It's amazing. I want you to all go and see this movie now so we can have a good episode about it. It's just super fun, and it does have a lot of you know, we talked about the different themes and whatever. There's a lot of interesting stuff in this movie that make it really interesting for its time. One of the main things is like we have Grace Jones and we also have Getty Watanabe, which you would remember from a bunch of those 80s movies. Asian American actor always plays the Asian American stereotype. Guess what? This is a horror movie made in the 1980s where an Asian guy does not have an Asian accent.
I think his name is Wilson also in it.
I'm going to say it again in the episode, but I want to say that now because I'm not sure what's more interesting, knowing that going in or being told after the fact, like, hey, by the way, did you notice the Asian guy doesn't have an Asian accent? This movie's from the 80s.
Yeah, he's Long Duck Dong in 16 Candles. Yeah. Oh, hello! You know, it's actually like an actual, I am an Asian man and I can speak English just as normally as you can.
Yeah, it's like, oh, yeah, I'm like an American citizen, bro. Like, what the fuck do you want? Like, so you have aspects of, when you talk about representation, there's some representation. It might not be the same kind of representation we talk about today. We didn't have this character whose like entire identity is rooted in his Asianness, but you do have an Asian character in a prominent role in a movie that is more than just being Asian. Some may call it like that quote unquote colorblind racism because there's nothing particularly Asian about him, but for the 80s it's completely fucking unheard of.
Absolutely, it's gonna be super fun. We should have Jenna back for that. She is still drippy, but she is feeling better, and I think Vamp is a movie she's actually really going to enjoy because Steve will pick the werewolf movie and I have no idea what she will pick, if she picks anything, this month. But it's gonna be a fun February. I'm super excited that we're kind of doing the monthly themes because it does kind of help make us a little bit more cohesive. In terms of the Patreon, I have decided we're going to release it mid-February, strictly just because we're just kind of putting the finishing touches on what exactly each tier is going to offer, what we're going to do. There is, like I said, there's going to be a show called After Hours, which is me and Steve probably doing dick and fart jokes, but maybe actually interesting conversations.
Also, low-key, my favorite Scorsese movie.
God. I was wondering if you're going to segue that in. That's not impressive to me. I was just waiting for it, so.
It is, though.
We also have Schlocked and Loaded, which is going to be an interview series. I'm going to take the helm on that, but Steve will be popping in for certain people. I'm working with, as I mentioned a couple episodes ago, Barbados, who is a fan, who's also an adult sexploitation comic writer. Already for what we've recorded has been really interesting. As me going solo without Steve to do an interview, but also kind of talking about uncomfortable things and examining arts and independent art. It's been really fun so far. That's going to be about a 6-part series. After that, I'm going to do a small series with Music Kill the President's Bruce Bambino, talking about modern hip hop and art, and him specifically working as an independent cinematographer at times. That's going to be super fun. We also have a couple other people. I'm solidifying the schedule. We're going to have a couple writers that we're going to do for that one. Another comic writer, a musician, and the one episode that we may or may not specifically release to you guys, it might sit on the Patreon for a while. We will have Mr. Peter Atkins of Hellraiser fame, who's written many, many of the sequels. He's written many sci-fi and horror and fantasy short stories and novels. He has been super kind, not only to agree to talk with us, he also seems very excited. We've been kind of talking back and forth the last couple days. He has lots of stories to share that he's apologizing in advance that we've probably heard, which I don't think is true, but it's going to be a very interesting episode. That's going to be in April, and I think for April we are going to probably do sequels, so we can definitely slide in a Hellraiser sequel into that. We're also going to be doing a
Hellworld.
It's going to be Hellworld or a Bloodline. It's going to be one or the other. I haven't decided yet.
Hellworld.
Besides that, we're going to be doing a flip-flop show with another horror podcast, Horrifying My Friends. Travis Ibarra, who runs that, is a friend of mine that I've gotten to know over the last couple months. We're going to do his show. And it's specifically, he's going to give us a movie we probably haven't seen, which is going to be tough for Travis because there's probably not a whole lot of ones off the top of his head that he might pick, but that'll be fun. And he's going to come on our show and just be, truly, I would say, one of the most knowledgeable, horror persons I've spoken to. He's horrible, but in a fun way.
Motherfucker, you just say speaking?
Speaking. Listen, I had a beer, and we've been doing this for way longer than we usually
do. Oh, you had one beer?
Listen, I'll tell you when I've had enough. And that's it. That's the show. We'll be back next week with Vamp. Steve, where do we find you if we want to find you?
Hit me up at Rude Speaker on all the things. I got stuff going on. Shit came up, so I didn't get to get that longer version of Cartoon Dracula, our theme song, out. That's definitely going to be coming soon. I want to stop putting dates on those things and saying I'm going to do
secrecy.
It. Because I don't do it. But find me a Rude Speaker. Follow me on Spotify so you'll know when that shit comes out. You can check out my other song, Universe. It's on Spotify. SoundCloud, I got a bunch of old stuff. It's interesting. It's not necessarily good, but it's interesting. So like, you can check that stuff out if you like me. See my bad jokes on Twitter. Get into our Discord now before it gets locked behind the Patreon. Whatever, man. Sorry I called you guys pigs and rambled a bunch today.
You're not sorry. Don't lie to them like that.
No, I'm not. I got a killing frenzy right as I said that. So
perfect. As long as you got something. Find me at DaGhoulDaddy on Instagram and Twitter. I am the most active on Twitter, but it seems that most of you that have hit me up to do interviews and everything like use Instagram. So either's fine. I'll talk to you regardless. Follow the show at GroovyLittlePod on the Facebook, on the Instagram, on the Twitter. It's not on the metaverse because that shit's fucking stupid. We will never, ever be meta except when we're being metaphysical.
Damn.
And if you want to send us something via email for whatever reason, at groovylittlespookshow@gmail.com, groovylittlespookshow@gmail.com. See you next week. Stay groovy. Adios.
Damn, that was actually really good.
Thank you.